Hi, this is Esty, host of the Friday A Public Affair. I hope you help us by contributing to WORT, and you can also subscribe to the podcast. Bye.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esty Dinor, and what a show we have for you today. But before we get there, I just want to remind you that our pledge drive is starting next week. And this time, the bosses at WORT have decided that we should do it without people who pledge up with us. And so we are asking you, our dear listeners, to do that for us. And you can do it by recording a shout out at a number that I will give you momentarily. Get your pens ready. If you like or love WORT generally, or A Public Affair generally, or specifically the Friday section, call 608-321-9594 and record peony of love or something like that. Tell people why you like the show or love the show and why they should pledge for it. So again, the number is 608-321-9594. And today we are going to get updates on Native struggles against mining and fossil fuels projects throughout the country. These are all projects that we have discussed, some of them numerous times in the past. And we'll find out today what's the latest. We have two good news. I hesitate to call them victories yet, and we'll explore why, but definitely good news. And two, where the fight goes on. We have a first here, I believe, three lawyers with us on the line today. Gussie Lord is managing attorney of Tribal Partnerships for Earth Justice. She has spent most of her career representing tribal governments, individuals, and Native-owned businesses. She has worked with dozens of tribes and has represented clients in federal, state, and tribal courts and administrative proceedings, and has helped tribes to develop and enforce their own environmental laws and regulations. She currently works on the Back 40 Mine, which, as I said, we've been following on the show since 2017. Gussie is a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. Also with us is Chase Iron Eyes Esquire, Lakota People's Law Project Lead Counsel. He has a distinguished career fighting for the civil rights of Native Americans, including serving as lead counsel in the Dakotas for the Lakota People's Law Project. He co-founded the Native news website, LastRealIndians.com, and he works in the Native Lives Matter movement. In 2016, he was a Democratic congressional nominee for North Dakota. He was involved from the beginning on the front lines of the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline, hosting tribal leadership, providing legal services, and joining the water protectors in their prayerful and peaceful protests, which I'm sure you all remember because we covered that in many shows. Born on Standing Rock Nation, today Chase lives at Pine Ridge as an enrolled member of the Oglala Nation. He holds bachelor's degrees in political science and American Indian Studies from the University of North Dakota and a Juris Doctor of Law degree with an emphasis in federal Indian law from the University of Denver's Sturm College of Law. And he has three Lakota children. And Frank Bebo is an enrolled member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe living on Leech Lake Reservation in Ball Club, Minnesota, where he's lived most of his life. It is a half mile away from the Enbridge Mainline Corridor, which is Line 3 plus Line 5. Frank is an attorney who works extensively with Chippewa treaty rights, civil rights, and sovereignty on and off reservation. He's executive director for the 1855 Treaty Authority and currently represents the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, which is 20,000 plus members in the proposed Line 3 replacement crude oil pipeline in Minnesota. He has been working with Honor the Earth for the past 7 years. It is a, as you surely know, a native-led nonprofit environmental protection group led by Winona LaDuke, litigating to stop Enbridge's Sandpiper pipeline first, and for the past 6 years, Line 3 replacement crude oil pipeline. Thank you so much for the three of you to join us. I think we have some amazing legal power here with us today. And let's start with the good news. Gussie, the Back 40 mine, if you want to remind our listeners what it is, what the struggle has been, and where we're at right now.
Sure. Thank you, Esty. The Back 40 mine is a proposed open pit mine. It would be in a sulfide ore body, which means that were that mine to go forward, some of the byproducts would be acid mine drainage. And that's problematic for a number of reasons. First of all, because it's only 150 feet from the Menominee River, the largest watershed in the Upper Peninsula and in Northeast Wisconsin, and it empties into Lake Michigan. In addition, the proposed site of the mine is directly within the site of a former Menominee village. It's about 3 miles of the river where the Menominee village was located along both sides of the river. And because that area has been relatively undeveloped, it retains a lot of the archaeological resources that show Menominee's occupation of that site. There are a bunch of burial mounds there. There are things like dance rings impressed in the ground that you can still see. And there's an extensive raised agricultural field complex there that represents the northernmost known maize production by prehistoric people. So basically the Menominee were modifying the landscape and raising corn far north of where people believed that was possible, where archaeologists believe that native people could grow corn, but the Menominee did it for a long time. And so it's really, you know, archaeologically significant. It's culturally significant to the Menominee people. And it's just, you know, it's just a unique resource. There are no other sites like that left in Michigan. All the others have been destroyed. So having the mine located there, you know, is a serious concern to the Menominee people who now live in Wisconsin and who don't have jurisdiction over that site anymore. So it's been a long fight, almost entirely within the state of Michigan. There are no federal permits for the project. One of the permits is a wetlands permit. Typically, those are federal permits. We made significant arguments all the way up to the Seventh Circuit that the federal government, the Army Corps, and EPA should be overseeing that 404 permit because it's on a bi-state waterway. However, we were unsuccessful in that lawsuit, and so we brought a case in the state administrative hearings process on the wetlands permit. And that's the victory you're talking about. It's been a long fight. The mining company put in several iterations of their wetlands permit application, and the impact to wetlands in each iteration of the permit. So in denying that permit, the ALJ held that you don't even show what impacts to wetlands are going to be. In order to get a permit, you have to know how many acres of wetlands, first of all, you're going to impact. And the mine wasn't able to show that. They didn't provide any evidence that there were reasonable alternatives considered to the proposed project. And one super important part of this is that the state agencies, the state employees looking at it, said, look, we shouldn't issue this permit. And the head of Michigan, what was at that time, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, issued the permit anyway, even over the objections of the state employees. So that was something I believe the ALJ really took into consideration here. And also of significance was that he noted that this would, you know, damage the cultural resources. So it was a huge victory for us. Of course, as you mentioned, it isn't over. Aquila, the mining company, has appealed to the state permit panel, and there is going to be a hearing on that next week on March 3rd.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about that? Do you think this will continue on for years, or do you think that you have a good chance of it ending here?
There are several permits required for an operation like this. We've been fighting the mining permit. There's an amended mining permit we're fighting. There's a permit to discharge wastewater into the river. There's a dam safety permit. All of those permits have to be issued before they can go forward. So it definitely could be, you know, a long fight. However, the wetlands permit is a big one. If they don't get that, they can't go forward. I mean, if they don't get any one of these permits, they can't go forward. We have a pretty good feeling about where this is. We believe our arguments are strong. We believe the fact that the state employees thought it was a bad idea to issue this permit, given its location, given the impacts it would have to the water resources, the cultural resources, things like lake sturgeon habitat. We believe that we're in a really strong position right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, good to hear. And Chase Aronize, you, as we noted in the introduction, have been involved in the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline right from the beginning. On July 6, 2020, a federal judge ruled that the owners of the Dakota Access Pipeline must halt operations while the government conducts a full-fledged analysis examining the risk that the pipeline poses to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. But again, this is not a full victory because the pipeline still operates, isn't it?
We, you know, these things never end. When to be born Indigenous means to be born into a struggle, at least in a very conscientious experience and awareness of that struggle against big extraction, against those same colonial forces that colonized Europe way before they got to our shores. So most Americans, most Canadians, most Australians, New Zealanders are completely asleep. They don't see themselves as connected to Mother Earth, or it takes some life-altering experience to kind of appreciate what indigeneity is and how it is simply a connection, a recognition, and a commitment to uphold our end of the bargain and have a respect relationship with Mother Earth. So when the Dakota Access Pipeline came onto my radar in February of 2016, I attended a couple of local community meetings, and that's when it was decided to set up a camp. Everybody saw in mid-August the arrests started, camp began to fill up, and we suffered egregious human rights violations, use of deadly force, negligent or intentional endangerment of human lives, reckless or intentional. You know, from the dog attacks of September 3rd to the mass arrest of October 27th, to Backwater Bridge, November 20th. Nobody has ever been made whole for that. But while all that was going on, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe had sued the Army Corps of Engineers over this permit, and over this, not just the permit, but the easement. I mean, the environmental impact statement is the Army Corps' compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act, cultural resource law. The suit was kind of limited in that scope, but we have to understand that the Lakota people, the Great Sioux Nation, signed treaties with the United States. We recognize the United States as our younger sibling sovereign, and we wanted relations with the United States to, I mean, we pledged our peace, but fast forward to And a lot of you who are listening followed everything that went down during our fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Almost 1,000 people were arrested. People were maimed. It's the first time we saw the militarized corporate state kind of orchestrating the arms and institutions of our state governments. There was a fusion center that was set up at this old fort. It's called Fort Rice. I grew up right next to Fort Rice. It's where one of our chiefs signed the treaty, Chief Gall. Just crazy, crazy things happened. And they kind of readied themselves, and we're able to see how, you know, militarized law enforcement, it treats American people based on Standing Rock and going right into Black Lives Matter, everything that happened after George Floyd was murdered. But after this judge, Boasberg, I can't remember the date, SD, I think he said July 26th or something like that, but he shut down the pipeline. He said, you know, you should not be illegally operating this pipeline. That decision was appealed to the DC Appellate Court, and then the DC Appellate Court recently came down with their decision vacating that easement that President Trump pretty much forced the Army Corps of Engineers to grant Energy Transfer Partners. The appellate court said, look, we recognize that that is not proper. It was done without any environmental impact statements, and we're going to vacate that permit. But we're not going to stop the illegal flow of oil, because we, the appellate court, think that Boasberg did not find sufficient grounds for an injunction, or that we didn't show sufficient grounds for an injunction. And for judging, I'm not in the case, so I can talk about the case differently than attorneys who are attorneys of record in that case. Uh-huh. We think that it's purely political. They were supposed to have a hearing on February 11th, the same day that Oscar Hayelk was being arraigned, a day after Oscar Hayelk was arraigned and faces 23 years in prison for his resistance to the Keystone XL pipeline. This is everything is politically motivated. There's not a move that we make in fighting big extraction that is not monitored, that is not watched, and that other side is completely ready. But right now, the EIS is supposed to take place, and they postponed the hearing again. They gave themselves 60 more days. President Biden, somebody in President Biden's team, no doubt, kicked this thing down the road for another 60 days. And so in that time, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, the Oglala Lakota Nation, Rosebud, I believe, is a Yankton Sioux Tribe. Four tribal nations sent a letter to President Biden asking him to stop the illegal flow of oil and allow us to do proper environmental impact statements, a statement on the whole corridor. And a host of celebrities have again launched their activity in the court of public opinion to get this thing shut down.
Mm-hmm. So same question to you. Are you hopeful? Are you questioning? What do you think the near future holds?
Yeah, I'm extremely hopeful. You know, I don't trust the courts at all. I mean, I'm a lawyer, and I realize lawyers got to make the arguments that lawyers are permitted to make inside the courtrooms. But what happens in the courtrooms is based on the front line. It's based on what's happening at line three. It's based on what was about to happen at KXL. It's based on our commitment and whether or not those who are in those elected offices and in those judiciary capacities feel pressured. And sometimes, you know, we can mount that kind of positive pressure like we were doing during the Standing Rock fight. I definitely feel with KXL being canceled, with Trump's border wall being canceled by President Biden, you know, even though the ICE is still operating and the indigenous cages for children just got an upgrade, they look a little nicer. And people like, you know, the squad and so forth are loudly silent on that. Even though Biden is bombing Syria, you know, people are making money. And they're making money on selling those cages for indigenous kids. They're making money on bombing Syria. Even though that is happening, Deb Haaland sits poised to be appointed as the next Secretary of the Interior. And we are extremely positive and encouraged, and we will not stop on our end. So, yeah, I feel okay about things.
All right. And Frank Bibo will get into the two lines that haven't gotten good news yet. We talked about line three about 2-3 months ago on this show, but tell us, remind us what this is all about and tell us where it's at right now.
Thank you. Line 3 is part of the pipeline complex that was part of the Kalamazoo federal litigation when the oil spill happened in 2010. And as a result of the consent decree with the federal government and the court, Enbridge was required to replace all of the pipeline along the corridor, which in the case of where we live here in Minnesota, includes Line 3. So that's where things start from. The pipeline, you know, they've been fighting this, or they applied for this 6 years ago. Most everything that Chase is talking about is the same thing that we've been going through, except we've had the time to look back at what happened with KXL and DAPL and try to integrate that into our strategies and things like that. And so Line 3 is being called a replacement pipeline, but in reality, it's not a replacement pipeline. It's a new pipeline. And it's also being mischaracterized, and so it's hard to stop, you know, the rolling train of, you know, thousands of jobs right here in Minnesota being advertised all the time. But in reality, Pipeline 3 that they're talking about replacing for safety conditions and things like that, because of the problems that it's had in the past and its relationship to the Kalamazoo oil spill, the largest oil spill here in North America in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, in 1991, the Kalamazoo, not the Kalamazoo, but the Cohasset spill in 2002, the Clearbrook facility where it had a fire and people died in their employment. The same with the Husky refinery that blew up here in Superior, Wisconsin here 2 years ago. The whole thing is a question about how safe it can be operated. And what they've been doing is running it at half volume, essentially half pressure. And as a result, for the last 10 years, which we didn't know while we were arguing at the beginning 6-7 years ago, is that because they've been running it at this lower pressure, they have actually had almost zero oil spills along Line 3 for the last decade. And so they don't really need to replace it in the sense that it had 5 spills, a total of 66 gallons, and 4 of them were right at the pumping stations. And the 5th one, I think, was in Canada, so it wasn't even in Minnesota. The crazy thing is that they're pumping half volume. The replacement pipeline is actually a 36-inch pipeline. The old one's a 34. So while it sounds like the same size, they're going to be pumping the full volume of a 36 and then increase the pumping capacity while running this pipeline through a pipeline corridor that would be a greenfield aside from other electrical transmission lines and things like that. And it's going right through the heart of wild rice country. The other pipelines go right through the heart of wild rice country also in all of our rivers and lakes here in Minnesota. But this would be a new corridor, and that's part of our concern, is that they really haven't figured out how to resolve the 6 pipelines in the corridor along Highway 2 where we live in Minnesota. And so as we go forward, the question is it a safety issue or is it an issue of supply? Because what we've also found is we've been engaged in this state appeal system, which is, you know, again, you know, it's really an odd system because they call it quasi-judicial. And so when Chase was talking about the legal system and what he's been, you know, engaging in, you get better, at least a judicial system. I'm talking quasi-judicial, which means the rules don't even always apply. And so when they went through their environmental review process with the Public Utilities Commission, they employed the administrative law judge to conduct the environmental hearings. And at the end of those hearings, the administrative law judge said, because of all the treaty rights and our resources and everything else that are out there, that the best thing to do and the least impactful to the environment would be for Enbridge to do an inline in-trench replacement right where Line 3 is now, take that out and put the new one in. But they weren't willing to do that. And so we've been in this struggle now for 6 years when they could have been probably pumping oil had they done that. The other thing that's happened, and it's kind of an interesting side piece to all of the environmental aspects, is that Enbridge is basically violating the law in the way that they've gone through the application process with the PUC. The PUC is what's legitimized it because it's quasi-judicial. Under state law, you're supposed to provide a supply, a demand analysis of why you need to have this pipeline. And they haven't done that. What they've done is they've provided a supply analysis because they've got this giant pile of tar sands crude in the ground that they want to extract and pump someplace to sell it. And so they say, we've got more than you ever need for the next, 20 years. Well, the problem is where is it really going to go, and isn't it going to go someplace? And if it is going to go someplace, then it's also an environmental concern, because that's the kind of tar sand oil that is probably the dirtiest to extract and probably the dirtiest to burn. And so at that point, you're really contributing to climate change and greenhouse gases. And that place is upstream from us. And our relationship, much like with DAPL and Enbridge and things like that, when Enbridge was first running their pipeline on the same corridor, their pipeline application in Minnesota called Sandpiper, they wanted to bring Bakken crude oil from North Dakota across a pipeline and bring it into Minnesota and run it south. And when they were required to do an environmental impact statement, they packed up their bags, took their money, and invested 27% into DAPL, and a month later, they were running bulldozers right across the pipeline and displacing people, and it became militarized. So that's what we see as Enbridge when we're engaging right now. So you have an ALJ with the recommendation to do an inline entrench emplacement, and the PUC says, no, we're not going to do that. We like this other route, and we're going to give it to them for other reasons. Well, that meant that when it went to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, they didn't do an environmental impact statement, and they just accepted what was going on from the Public Utilities Commission. So there was no other environmental review there. So by the time it gets to the Corps of Engineers, they're supposed to do some kind of cumulative impact assessment, and they're piggybacking on what the PCA did. The PCA did nothing. And what it's relying on is what the Public Utilities Commission, which was ignoring our treaty rights publicly. So how can we not be appealing and trying to fight these things? The problem is that while as tribes, as Indians, when we try to engage ourselves into their legal system, we're caught up in participation. But then because the PUC authorized their permitting again, we have to go through an appeal process. Well, the appeal process, if we're going to participate in the state system, the judicial system, then they should have to wait until the appeals have been heard. They should have to see if they're actually going to prevail at the end of the day, not start running pipeline. And by the time we get some decisions out of the Court of Appeals or other places, they may have already run all the pipe. And we can see what's going on from what they're talking about right now and with KXL and things like that, with running oil, no matter what, whether they've been told to or not. And we've got those same kind of trespasses here at the Red Lake and places where they've been going across Indian country, and they are not paying their leases. They're trying to figure out how to do a settlement, but you cannot make them stop. I think Bad River has had a order for 6 years to try to make them stop. Enbridge will not stop pumping oil.
Yeah. Well, we are talking today with three Native American lawyers who are involved in some way or another in struggles against fossil fuels and mining projects. You just heard Frank Bibo about Line 3. We also have with us Gussie Lord about the Back 40 mine, and she's also involved with Line 5, which we'll get to very soon, and Chase Iron Eyes about the Dakota Access pipeline. Frank, I hope that we'll get to talk about also the resistance. I'll just say I've been watching the videos of people sitting there in the freezing cold of Minnesota winter, and some of them have been arrested, and I'll ask you more about that in a moment. But There's important news, I think, from this week that two men were arrested and charged on February 24th in a human trafficking sting in Itasca County. They were working on Enbridge Line 3 pipeline replacement project. And that takes me to that issue of how these projects, of course, are extremely disruptive and destructive to all aspects of the environment, but they also are to the native tribes that or bands that live near them. And one of them is the issue of men camps, as they're known, and the issue of murdered and missing indigenous women. Do you want to talk about this case and its implications?
It's just one more aspect that we tried to raise issues about at the Public Utilities Commission and in other places about the safety and welfare of Minnesotans. You know, Winona just tried to call me, but I cut her off because, you know, I'm on the radio show with you, but she might be listening and wanted to even talk about this issue. But, you know, one of the things that happened at the Public Utilities Commission, and Kutuma was probably the person who kind of led the charge on this, but basically they told all of law enforcement that we will reimburse you for whatever your costs are related to any kind of arrest or court or criminal process or whatever you want to call it, prosecutions, for everything that comes up. And so what you have is a whole bunch of people who already feel like they've got some kind of privilege, because apparently law enforcement isn't out there trying to, you know, protect our rights because we're still appealing in court. Law enforcement is out there trying to prevent us from protecting our rights on the ground as well. You know? And so when you have people like this, they feel like they can bring this kind of thing up. And it's not just in Itasca County. It's been notorious for a long time in Duluth Superior, where the ships come and go and things like that. But any place where you have a whole bunch of people like this in isolated rural areas, there's going to be people coming up trying to make money off of them and exploit them. And unfortunately, it spills right over into our communities. We're as concerned about this kind of a thing as we are about COVID. Because all of these people, when they come in, and thousands of people who are coming in from Louisiana, Texas, Alabama, Arkansas, Oklahoma, wherever, all of these guys are coming in. And where do you think they go at night? They go into our little tiny communities, and they want to go into our little restaurants and things and go back to work with each other the next day. You know, they're just as vicious as a group in terms of, you know, maybe what happened a long time ago with the trying to get us through germ warfare, you know. Why is this allowed to be going on when they don't need to be doing this right now? This, to me, it gets everybody. It's terrible to be doing this to women. It's terrible that it's happening here in Itasca County where I live. And we've seen this, and we don't think it's going to be the last. We tried to warn them, but they have encouraged people, you know, the PUC in particular, to just come on up and do what you want. And they're going to try to prevent us from protecting people and protecting women. And we're going to be out there in the struggle. And right now, it's mostly women who are on the front line as water protectors right now for the reason of the kind of abuse that can occur. A lot of times, men feel very inclined to be very physically abusive to men in public during the daylight. And it's hard to do that with the lights and the cameras on when it's women. But, you know, they still find time during the dark in other ways and other places to still do those same kinds of intimidation.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. Gussie, I don't know if there's something you'd like to add to that issue. And also, I want to hear from you about Line 5, which I think is the least known of these projects, and it is right here in Wisconsin.
Sure. Thanks, Esty. You know, as a Native woman, issues that Frank talked about, they're always in the back of my mind and our minds. And, you know, it's, of course, it's not just there. It's in all these places where we've seen man camps where we see people come in from other areas, you know, up in Alaska when they built a pipeline, you know, in Canada, in South America. I mean, it's not just here. It's Indigenous women everywhere. And of course, it's not just limited to Indigenous women, but I'll just say that it's something that's always certainly in the back of my mind and in others' minds, and it's endemic. That's just what I'll say about that. With regard to...
Cassie, before we go to line five, the numbers that I read suggest that mostly it is white men who are harming Native women. Is that what you know too?
That's my understanding. It's also a problem with the jurisdiction, with the jurisdictional issue. You know, predators know that they're non-Indian and they're on tribal lands, that it's less likely they'll be prosecuted. There's been, you know, ongoing efforts through the Violence Against Women Act to apply that to tribes and to make sure that tribes can bring criminal prosecutions against people who abuse women in Indian country. You know, it's difficult. It's been slow moving. Sometimes it's funded, sometimes it isn't. Right now we're seeing it go forward in a number of tribal court systems. It would be great if tribes just had, you know, blanket jurisdiction over everyone within their borders, regardless of whether those people are or are not Native Americans. And until that's true, there's going to be a jurisdictional gap there, and people who are inclined to prey upon Native people are going to exploit that gap.
Yeah, thank you. So, line five.
Sure. So, line five is just another section of Enbridge's Lakehead system. The Bad River Band up in Wisconsin is fighting to get Line 5 expelled from the reservation, as Frank mentioned. And also the Bay Mills Indian community and a number of other tribes in Michigan are fighting Line 5 where it crosses under the Straits of Mackinac. Line 5 currently lies along the lake bed there. It's at the confluence of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. If there were to be a spill there, the currents are so strong because it's the narrowest point. It narrows right there and makes the currents really strong. If there were to be a spill there, it would just be devastating to the water in that whole region. Bay Mills has commercial treaty fishing rights that are protected. They've subsisted on fishing in those waters for millennia. And they're concerned about this replacement project that was approved by the previous governor of Michigan, Governor Schneider, to grant an easement to build a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac and house that pipeline there. And, you know, it's been touted as like a much safer option, but they haven't fully examined the geography there. It's not great to build a tunnel underneath the Great Lakes and permanently put that infrastructure there where, you know, certainly, it's my position that's not needed. We don't need to entrench this fossil fuel infrastructure for another 60 or 100 years. What we need to do is get it out of there. Line 5 is essentially a shortcut through Canada. It brings that oil from Canada through, you know, through the upper Midwest and back to Canada. A lot of it's made into petrochemicals. You know, a lot of it's burned. It's just a climate disaster, or, you know, just as the climate disaster. And The good news on Line 5 is that Michigan's current governor, Governor Whitmer, has rescinded the easement along the lake bed there. Enbridge has says it will not comply and that it is entitled to continue pumping oil through there, regardless of the fact that the Governor Whitmer has said that, you know, it violates the public trust. It's not safe. It's a concern. It needs to be removed. So that's currently being fought out in the courts in Michigan. Our role at Earth Justice, our Midwest office, is representing Bay Mills in their fight on, and again, it's a multifaceted fight. You know, they're before the Utilities Commission on siting, they're before EGLE on, or excuse me, the Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy on, you know, wetlands permit, on a NPDES permit to discharge into the water, on a lake bed permit, on whether that can be there. There's also going to be required an Army Corps 404 permit, like the ones at issue for both Line 3 and Dakota Access Pipeline. And that hasn't yet been issued. We're hopeful that with the new administration coming in, there will be people in charge at Army Corps that will take a harder look At these permits and impacts to tribal resources, treaty protected resources, water impacts, climate impacts, all those things will be considered in the decision to issue a permit, is our hope. So that's a little bit in the earlier stages, but certainly that fight's been going on for a long time as well. There are certainly a lot of tribes leading the charge in that fight and a lot of other allies as well.
And certainly something we need to pay attention to and to keep looking at. And it's amazing to me that both Enbridge and Aquila, the one that was trying or is still trying to build the Back 40, first of all, they're Canadian and they can destroy lands in the United States. And not only, especially Enbridge and other Canadian companies are all over the place. And we'll actually be talking next week, listeners, about how mining for gold has destroyed native lands in Central America. So I hope you tune in again next week. But first of all, why are corporations from one country allowed to destroy lands in another country, lands and water and so on and so forth? And secondly, how can they decide not to accept what the governor says? So if you can just respond to that briefly, Gussie.
Sure, I'd like to, I guess, bring it back to something Chase said, and that's, you know, these companies will continue to fight. They'll bring every resource to bear. They'll, you know, refuse to comply. You know, we've seen Standing Rock and their allies win a number of victories in court, and yet, as you mentioned earlier, the oil is still flowing. You know, they've rescinded the easement in Michigan. That's to take effect in May, and then Richard said, we're not going to comply. You know, they've tried to shut it down in a number of places, and in the oil industry and the fossil fuel industries have historically been so powerful and had so many resources that, you know, they feel like they don't have to comply. And so far, you know, that's been correct. But I think we all see that the tide is turning. Tribes are powerful as well. Tribes have a strong voice as well. This is a long fight. This is just the stage in the fight that's been going on for hundreds of years. And, you know, we're certainly not giving up either. We're still here. We're going to continue to protect the resources that are important, not only for tribes, but for everybody and for the future generations.
Yeah.
You asked another question. I can't remember what it was.
I mean, I think you answered. Thank you. Chase, anything you would like to add to that question? And then I want to talk to you about resistance and so on.
I feel that, and thank you. Thank you to Gussie and to Frank. It's good to meet you over the air, even, and thank you, Esty, for hosting us. These discussions are, these are extremely important because of the situation that we're in our country. We just survived a racist, deliberate, attempted, violent, fascist overthrow of the United States government over the United States open, free, and fair elections. There's blood inside the United States Capitol because of the racist and fascist demographic that the white supremacists in this country, who are the greatest threat to our collective national security, play hand in hand with big extraction. And big extraction hires companies like Blackwater or Tiger Swan or other private military contractors to plan out and execute their oil war theater experience here in our homelands and violate our constitutional rights, our natural rights, our birthrights. They just don't care. They don't care about nationality. They don't care what country they're in. As long as those corporations are making money, we have to show up and fight on our side inside the courtroom as attorneys. Sometimes that also means that we have people who are charged, wrongfully charged. We consider them to be politically charged. Everybody who's facing arrest at line 3, I did not know about line 5. Thank you for mentioning that, Gussie. And KXL. There are two people facing charges for KXL right now. Voting. We just saw the power of the native vote. We saw how we can swing entire elections and determine the direction that we're going as a country. And we're waking up to the fact that these foreign extractive corporations, they do not get to dictate our energy policy anymore. We can choose to force our elected leadership to incentivize renewable economies. For instance, Biden put a pause on all oil and gas leases on federal lands. That's a good step, but there's a lot of tribes who are under that pressure, who've incorporated those extractive, you know, virus-like economic cultural behaviors into their lives. Whether it's Blackfeet or Osage or Southern Ute, and I got people in each of those places that I know. I'm just saying that they made those decisions under economic duress. Same thing with Fond du Lac. There is serious things brewing at Fond du Lac. I don't remember the name of the resistance camp there, but it's got the tribal government fighting its own citizens and those who came to help protect their water resources. There are threats being made against indigenous water protectors, threats against their children, and it's a situation that we need to keep an eye on. We went through this fight in DAPL, and we got to continue to advocate, continue to educate, because the corporations do not care, but there is an opportunity. There is an ability that we have to pursue. We've got to more than believe in it. We've got to know it, that we can recognize each other's humanity and save ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you briefly, Chase, about the really unprecedented situation that was at Standing Rock, starting with the gathering of the tribes, and then I think like maybe 15,000 people at the time from all over the world, all over the country. That was amazing. And even though it didn't bring an immediate victory, I think it still reverberates. And I want you to talk about that because of Line 3, because as I said, I've been seeing, you know, the maybe a dozen, two dozen at a time. How do you get more people to know and support and be part of the resistance to these pipelines?
It's not an easy task, you know, as I just mentioned in Fond du Lac, but in Standing Rock at Ocheti, we had to rely on tribal governments, elected tribal governments, which are beholden to their creation, their arms and institutions of the federal colonial imposition of authority here on Turtle Island in this country. But elected leaders sometimes are not aware that we are prior sovereigns with inherent authorities to say what we are, recognize what we are, and tell the world what we are. So at Standing Rock, we had to rely on the tribal council to lead the fight, provide that legitimacy, that air of authority for that on the ground resistance. And then it caught on in a mainstream way as more arrests were made. And then when it wasn't Tiger Swan, but I think it was Latent Security, they were called, they used deadly force with those vicious attack dogs on September 3rd, 2016, and people were attacked. People were maimed and hurt throughout the process of that whole pipeline fight. But Standing Rock, Ocheti, the confluence of what is now called the Missouri and Cannonball Rivers, was another recurring path in our spiritual liberation because of the English thinking universe, because of the colonial foundational way that we, you know, interpret and perceive our universe. We're not taught that quote unquote natural resources have intrinsic value. But indigenous peoples have ceremonies where you don't drink water or eat food for 4 days. And so you learn very quickly that our worldview that we try to walk with every day gives us the authority to defend Mother Earth, which in turn defends our waters and our the health of our ecosystem. So that is a spiritual awakening that can happen to all of us in this country. We just have to kind of liberate from those categories that we were assigned to.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. And Frank, looks like you are going to have the last word. So there is that ongoing protest. There have been arrests. Anishinaabe water protector Tanya Obid is, I believe, now on hunger strike, or maybe was. In January, hundreds of water protectors walked in onto Line 3 worksite, and 8 of them arrested. And in the meantime, we see what happened in the Capitol. You have about 2 minutes to respond to that, and also maybe to call on other people to come and join your folks up there.
Well, thank you. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people coming already. It's just cold in northern Minnesota. It's going to be a nice place to be as the temperatures warm up. And, you know, we've been expecting to have our own DAPL here for a long time. So that's already happening. One of the things that we learned about DAPL, and Chase was just talking about it in a different way, is that the tribes weren't working with the Indians on the ground. And one of the things that we're doing with the White Earth Band of Ojibwe is we're looking at establishing off-reservation tribal court also, which, you know, has to do with our natural resources. And like Chase was talking about, we have a relationship with the earth and all of the other pieces that keep us alive. We're all interconnected. And so we, as a person or as people who have property rights to the water under the federal laws, or even to the resources under the federal laws, then we also have, as being discussed, the inherent rights. And we have the inherent right to protect that property, our relations. And that's what we're out there doing. And so people do need to come. Right now it's cold, but we are providing codes so that those issues that are really civil regulatory, like trespass, if we have a right to be there already, how can you charge us with trespass? If we have a right to be there already, how can you charge us with assembly? How can you get us for free speech if we have a right to be there to defend our property? And so we're using their legal system in a different way against them because of what we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank the three of you so much for taking time from your busy life. And I want to thank you also for the work that you all do really for all of us. Native and not Native, really appreciate you being with us. Chase Iron Eyes, Frank Bibo, and Gassie Lord, really appreciate that. And Richelle, thank you for producing and engineering. I'm STD Noor, like I said. Next week, we will continue talking about these issues, and you can record shout outs for us in the meantime at 608-321-9594. Thank you. Thank you, amazing lawyers. Appreciate you joining us. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication about